Okay, so this isn't quite the reference I was looking for, I don't think. But anyway, it has this nice little quote here, which just is a bit beside the point now, but this is this quote here, talking after the Niigata Nataputta dies, leader of the Jains, and Ananda expresses his fear that after the Buddha dies, the Sangha might get into arguing and disputing. And the Buddha's response is quite interesting. He says, it's apamattaka, it's trivial, is the disputes about the livelihood and the parimokkha. But if anybody argues about the path or the way of practice, if the Sangha argues about the path, way of practice, then this will kind of dispute will be for long for the harm and the danger for and the suffering for gods and men. So that's always good to bear in mind if people have different opinions on the Vinaya. But that's not quite what I was after. There is a place somewhere where it talks about Abhidhamma, and then it suggests that the Abhidhamma maybe consists of this group of dhammas we have here, which is the we call the seven or the 37 Bodhipakkhya dhammas, the four Satipatthanas, four right efforts, four Iddhipadas, four spiritual faculties. Five spiritual faculties, five spiritual powers, seven awakening factors, and the Eightfold Path. So this group of dhammas mentioned frequently in the suttas, and it seems that teachings based on those may have been a part of or constituted part of the earliest Abhidhamma. Now, one of the things that we can see today is that the teachings on those things in the suttas are all collected as part of the Samyutta Nikaya. And it was my theory developed when I was doing the research for History of Mindfulness, that the list of topics which constitute the Samyutta Nikaya in fact formed the framework for the earliest Abhidhamma system. And that list of topics includes these seven groups of dhammas on the path, and also the important wisdom topics that we find in the Samyutta Nikaya, which are, if we find a list of them, here, but the Nidana is the dependent origination, the Khandhas, five Khandhas, six sense bases, and the other ones is the Vedana, the feeling, and the Dhatus, and the Four Noble Truths. So these are all in there in the Samyutta Nikaya. So this is my suggestion, is that this central list of topics found in the Samyutta Nikaya form the basis for the earliest Abhidhamma system, and we'll show quite a few versions of that later on. In fact, I can find it for you right here. I made a bit of a table in the History of Mindfulness, which, if I've got it here, where's it gone? Here's the table I made here. It's a very partial group, and it's not really important to know all the details of what's on here, but just to give you just an idea of what I was talking about, and this idea of the Samyutta as the basis, very important, the list, basis for later developments. And here's the list of topics in the Samyutta Nikaya: dependent origination, the elements, aggregates, sense media, feelings, Eightfold Path, and awakening factors, various Bodhipakkhya dhammas, and so on. Now, this is the earliest Theravada, one of the earliest Theravada Abhidhamma treaties, the Vibhanga, we'll have a look at in a minute, has a similar sets of topics: the aggregate, sense media, elements, truths, 22 faculties, dependent origination, Satipatthana, right efforts, and so on. There's another book here called the Dhammahadaya, a list of, this is a part of the Vibhanga. And again, repeats a similar list of topics. Another work here, the Dhatu Katha, again has the aggregates, sense media, blah, 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 similar list of topics. And then another book in the Abhidhamma, Yamaka, again a similar list, Visuddhimagga and its discussion of wisdom and so on, has a similar list of dhammas. And in the Sarvastivadin scriptures, in the Samyukta Agama, again has a similar list, the book called the Dharma Skanda, which is we'll look at in a minute, again has a similar list. This time it's reversed. Here the path ones are up first. Basis of psychic power, satipatthanas, and so on. And the wisdom ones, the faculties, sense media, aggregates, elements, dependent origination, are down at the end. So they've swapped it around. Another Sarvasivada Abhidhamma book, Dhatukaya, again has a similar arrangement. And in the Dharmaguptaka, Shariputra Abhidharma, again has sense media, elements, aggregates, noble truths, faculties, awakening factors, and so on, dependent origination, satipatthanas. So, and then if we come even to the Mahayana texts, again we find the same list of topics again and again and again. Shravaka Bhumi is a very important Mahayana Shastra treatise, and the same aggregates, elements, sense media, dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, Satipatthana, right efforts, basis, psychic power, etc. The Heart Sutra again has a similar list of topics, aggregates, sense media, 18 elements, dependent origination, so on. Abhidharma Samuchaya is this book here, it's a Mahayana Abhidharma book. Again, similar list of topics. Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra is one of the Mahayana Yogacara Sutras. Artha Vinishtaya Sutra, again, similar. Madhyanta Vibhaga Bhashya, a treatise by Vasubandhu, I think. Again, a similar list. So all the way through, the point of that is simply to point out that this list of topics that we find in the Samyutta Nikaya originally then goes all the way through the whole Indian Buddhist tradition. Okay, and every stage of Buddha, of course, they all interpreted and explained things in different ways, but the basic framework remains the same. And so I think that this list of topics, or something like it, constituted perhaps the earliest thing that we can call Abhidhamma, in the sense of like a comprehensive overview of the teachings. Yogacara literally means the practice of meditation, and it was one of the two main Indian Mahayana schools. Yeah, the two is Yogacara and the Madhyamaka. The Chan school arose in China. So the Chan school actually has elements of both Yogacara and Madhyamaka in it. Yeah. But the way that the schools developed in China wasn't exactly the same as the way it developed in India. So, although they had the same texts, but they're sort of the schools that develop on the basis of them were developed in a different way. But certainly that Yogacara was very influential in Chan, probably the most influential school in the development of Chan. Okay, so that's just a very, very quick overview, just to show this kind of, I wanted to show this kind of connect, because we'll be talking about the development of things and how they change over time, but also just to emphasize this continuity as well. Yeah? It's not, the fact that things develop and evolve doesn't mean that they just completely reinvent things, but they all acknowledge the importance of these groups of teachings. All right. Coming into meanings of Abhidhamma. So this is the early meaning of Abhidhamma, was the discussion about the Dhamma. And in this sense, the modern Pali scholars say that Abhi in the Abhidhamma means about. Okay, and this, you have a similar usage actually here in this passage we just noted here, when it says discussion. If they should have a dispute, adhajive. It's a similar use of the prefix about livelihood. Or adhipadimokkhe, about the padimokkha. Right? So the idea here is that the word abhi, the prefix abhi in Abhidhamma, originally meant about the Dhamma, in the sense of having discussions about the Dhamma. Right? So the Dhamma itself, of course, being the teachings of the Buddha, and the Abhidhamma being the discussions by the disciples. So that's the earliest usage. And the second kind of layer of usage is what we call the Abhidhamma Pitaka. So the Abhidhamma Pitaka is a collection of specific texts which are regarded as canonical within the schools, and which encapsulate the particular Abhidhamma system of that school. Unlike the suttas and to some extent the Vinaya, which are held in common throughout all the schools, the books of the Abhidhamma Pitikas were, as far as we can tell, more or less distinct in each school. Okay, so we don't have Abhidhammas for all of the schools. We've got more or less complete collections of the Abhidhamma Pitika from three schools, and each one is quite different. So the existing ones is the Theravada. Sarvastivada, our old friends, and the Dharmaguptaka. And these Theravada, of course, is in Pali, Sarvastivada and Dharmaguptaka in Chinese translation. Right. And apart from a few bits and pieces, there's no complete Abhidhamma works in either Tibetan or Sanskrit, so we've only got the Chinese translations for these things. Right, so that's the canon, and that was formed, say, in the early period of the formation of the schools. You know, and you think of it like, say, a university curriculum on Dhamma. You know, people have had their basic training and grounding in Dhamma. They want to get a systematic overview of it, and so that was what the Abhidhamma Pitaka was intended to provide. And even though they are largely sectarian works, in the sense that they were compiled separately by the schools during the sectarian period, with some important exceptions, but even though they're largely sectarian, it doesn't necessarily mean that they disagree all that much. Okay? Most of the things that we find in the Abhidhamma Pitaka are actually fairly conservative in terms of their doctrinal development from the suttas. Okay? And so they don't... There might be some things where you might argue, yes, they've changed the perspective of the suttas in some things, and you might see certain differences between them. But that's a fairly minor percentage of it. For the most part, it's a compendium and a collation and an analysis of things which are already familiar from the suttas. And we'll have a look in a minute at how that does that. Okay, so we shouldn't think that they're completely disparate in any way. Now then, that's the second layer or usage of Abhidhamma Pitaka. And then the last usage of Abhidhamma, I'm not sure how to put this, Abhidhamma is, they say, the Shastras. And this refers to basically all of the post-canonical literature. So if the canon was closed, say, 100 BC or something like that, roughly, then the Abhidhamma Shastras, treatises on the Abhidhamma, books on the Abhidhamma, we're now moving into the literary period of actually composing written texts, then these continue to be compiled by the schools. Okay, and so these are post-canonical, and they exist in Pali, Chinese, and Tibetan, and probably some Sanskrit fragments as well. So it's interesting to note that virtually all of the Abhidhamma is studied a lot in Tibet, but all of their Abhidhamma works are in fact post-canonical. They don't have any canonical works. They're mostly what they study is the what's referred to as Abhidhamma. If you're talking with monks in Tibet, Tibetan tradition, often what Abhidhamma is effectively the works of Vasubandhu. It's written about 400 AD, the Abhidhamma Kosha. If you're talking with Theravadan monks, what they say is Abhidhamma is usually, again, it's usually what's found in these shastras. It's not usually what's found in the Pitaka. Okay, so what the Theravadan monks say Abhidhamma, when they talk about Abhidhamma, usually they'll be talking about what's found in the Visuddhimagga, or the Abhidhamma commentaries, or else later Abhidhamma works like this one, which is the Abhidhamma Tathasangaha by a monk called Kassapa, Anuruddha. A monk called Anuruddha, Burmese monk about the 11th or 12th century AD. That's actually the basic text of Abhidhamma in the Theravada countries today. So if you go to Burma or Sri Lanka and study Abhidhamma in the universities and so on there, this will be the basic text, and then of course various commentaries on this. Okay, and that has an ongoing history, and during the 19th century that became a fiery controversy. Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about it a bit in his introduction to this, and there was a Lady Sayadaw wrote this whole series of attacks on the various sub-commentaries which had been written on this book, and that became a very fiery and divisive topic in the Burmese Sangha in the 19th century. And then the early 20th century, another monk wrote a commentary called the Navanita commentary, which means the butter commentary, yeah? Because he was trying to smooth everything over, yeah? So he tried to avoid all the controversial parts of it. And that's more or less what Bhikkhu Bodhi did in his commentary as well. So this is like the latest commentary on the Abhidhamma to Sangha, so it's still a living tradition. So this is typically, and that's, for example, that's what I was taught when I learned Abhidhamma in the monastery in Thailand. Basically, I taught modern works that were based on the Abhidhamma to Sangha. Okay. So that just gives you a bit of an overview of the different things that are called Abhidhamma.
But this modern work, well, relatively, what was it, 11th century?
Yeah.
Is that in itself refer to the sort of, you know, the really early Abhidhamma?
Not
or
so much.
Is it commenting directly on the suttas?
No, neither. It's developed a later system.
So what does it do then?
This particular book is this is an extensive commentary. The actual book itself is quite short, Abhidhamma to Sangha, and it's extremely dense. And it's basically a dense list of doctrinal propositions which were sort of meant to be elucidated with various things. So just a random one here, it says, analysis of functions. In the compendium of functions, there are 14 functions. Namely, 1, rebirth, blinking, life continuum, adverting, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, receiving, investigating, determining, javana, registration, and death. Their further classification should be understood by way of stage as tenfold, namely rebirth, linking, life continuum, adverting, fivefold sense consciousness, and so forth. Right? So that's what this consists of.
So what they're trying to put in a few paragraphs, what they might get in 10 sutras or something like that.
But it's also it's a system which has evolved a long way beyond the anything you find in the suttas.
When you say evolved a long way beyond,
yeah, okay.
In literary terms, or in terms of adding,
in every term,
to the philosophy or to the method.
Yep, all of those things. Yeah, in every way. Yeah. So, for example, when we looked at the Samyutta Matika, you know, you have the familiar categories like the five khandhas.
Mm.
So those have almost been completely superseded.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so things like, you know, those conventional categories are almost outdated by the time of this late Abhidhamma thing, yeah. They have different ways of classifying things. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you can carry it around with you on Tudong. Yeah. Apparently, Ajahn Mun used to carry it on Tudong. I've never had that confirmed, but that's what I heard a long time. So, okay. So let's just come back to the early Abhidhamma and have a bit of a look at some of the things that it might consist of. Now, I mentioned previously that this Samyutta Matika was one of the Samyutta Matika is the list of topics of the Samyutta. It's an important thing. And so here is a book called the Vibhanga. And here is the list of topics of the Vibhanga. And we have the khandhas, ayatanas, dhatus, satcha, the Four Noble Truths, indriyas, the faculties, dependent origination, satipatthanas, right efforts, ittipadas, awakening factors, etc., 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 all of the familiar topics that we've had from the Samyutta. And at the end, a few slightly interestingly different things. Jnana vibhanga, an analysis of different kinds of knowledge. Kuddhakavattu is an interesting one. It's basically a list of different kinds of mental factors and defilements and things like that. Dhammahadaya vibhanga is also historically quite interesting, and it's almost like an independent treatise which has been subsumed within the vibhanga. But leaving those ones aside, just looking at the mainstream thing, let's have a look at how it works. Okay, so this is the Kanda Vibhanga, first chapter, and it's divided into three parts. Suttanta Bhajaniya, the analysis according to the Sutta, the Abhidhamma Bhajaniya, analysis according to the Abhidhamma, and the Vanha Puchaka, the questions section. Okay? Remembering that I said that this Abhidhamma project probably originated through this process of questioning and counter-questioning. Okay, so, and here under the first stage of the what it calls the Suttanta Bhajaniya, okay, we open this up. What does it say? Five khandas: Rupa Khanda, Vedana Khanda, Samya Khanda, Sankara Khanda, Vijnana Khanda. So it's a simple list of the five khandas. Now it doesn't get much more stripped back than that. Right, simply listing them. It's not obvious from there that it's actually quoting from the suttas, but if we compare with some other passages, for example, let's have a look at the Satipatthana Vibhanga. Same thing, Sutta, Abhidhamma, and Panapuchika, three sections. And in here, under the Suttanta Bhajaniya, it says, here a bhikkhu internally contemplates body as a body, externally contemplates body as a body, internally and externally contemplates a body and body, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having removed covetousness and greed for the world. Internally contemplates feeling as feelings, and mind as mind, dhamma as dhamma, and so on. So it's basically a quote from the suttas with a slight, almost a literal quote from the suttas. So when it talks about Suttanta Bhajaniya, that's exactly what it is. It's an analysis of things, basically a quote taken from the suttas and then given further analysis. So back to the khandas, the quote from the suttas here is stripped back to as far as it can get. It's just a list of the names of the khandas. And if we look in Rupa Khanda, then it says, what is the Rupa Khanda, the aggregate of form? Whatever form, past, present or future, internal or external, coarse or fine, superior or inferior, whether far or near. Okay, and that of course is just a quote from the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. And again, notice that that's very characteristic of the Sanyutta Nikaya. This phrase occurs time and time again. Now this little bit here is added at the end. And what does that say? That says, taking it all as one, putting it all together and gathering it all together, that's called the Rupa Khanda. Right? So this is all that it's saying. What its point is here, that it's that the Rupa Khanda, as an aggregate of form, is not a particular instance, but it's a category that gathers all of those things together. So that's all that that's clarifying here. Okay? Then it says, and then what is form that is past? Whatever form is past, ceased, gone, finished, gone to meet its maker, ex-Rupa, deceased, pushing up the daisies, and so on, is past, right? And then it has the phrase that it's the four great elements, and the rupa that's defined, derived from the four great elements, this is called rupa of the past. And what's rupa of the future? Future rupa that has not, that is not yet born, that has not come to be. Oh, it must be a Nibbana rupa. Here's Ajatam Abhutam. Oh. It's not come born, not being produced, not being fully produced, not manifested, not arisen, not really arisen, not appeared, not really appeared, and so on. There's these lists of synonyms. In the future, and gathered together in the future, the four elements and form derived from the four great elements is called form of the future. And what is form of the present? And so it goes. And what is form that's internally? form, whatever of those beings is internally pertaining to themselves, in oneself, personal, and originated through grasping, then the four great elements and so on, this is the internal form, and the opposite is external form. And so it goes on defining each term of the passage from the sutta. Okay? Some of the definitions we meet in the suttas themselves, some of them are new to the Abhidhamma. So this is the Suttanta Bhajaniya. It's an example of the Suttanta Bhajaniya. And if we look at the Abhidhamma Bhajaniya, again, start with the same list. Chakanda, Rupa Kandho. Okay. Now, we get something that's a bit different. Now, what is the Rupa Kanda? What is Rupa Kanda? Eka Vidhena Rupa Kandho. Of one kind is the Rupa Kanda, something like that. All Rupa, not a cause, not pertaining to a cause, is disconnected from a cause, is with condition, is conditioned, is form, is worldly, is pertaining to defilements, is pertaining to fetters, pertaining to bonds, pertaining to floods, pertaining to bindings, pertaining to hindrances. These are all different words for defilements, pertaining to apprehension, pertaining to grasping, pertaining to defilement, is undeclared, undefined, without an object, not mental, separated from the mind, neither with result nor it is neither subject to never vipaka na vipaka dhamma dhamma. You know what that means, right? It's neither of the nature of result nor of the nature of result. Okay, something like that. Don't ask, alright? It's neither defiled nor subject to defilement. It's both with vitaka and without, and so on and so forth, right? So this is a list of technical terms taken from the Abhidhamma, okay? And we'll show where it's taken from in a minute. And they're being applied to the Rupa Kanda in various ways. Now, of course, the way that it's applying it there is entirely obscure. It's not particularly obvious what it's doing. And so this is where it gets into the much more complex aspects of the Abhidhamma. But essentially, this list is a standard list of dhammas. Okay? And so what it's doing is it's taking each instance of the Abhidhamma and it's applying it in context of each one of these terms and saying, does this apply or does it not apply? Okay? And then here it's doing, and this is, so this is Rupa that's one-fold, here's two-fold, by two-fold the Rupa Kanda, there is Rupa that is arisen, there is Rupa that is not arisen, there is Rupa that is grasped, there is Rupa that is not grasped, there is Rupa that is grasped and subject to grasping, there is Rupa that is not grasped and subject to grasping, there is Rupa that is manifestive and there is Rupa that is non-manifestive, there is Rupa that's resistant and Rupa that's not resistant, there is Rupa that is a faculty, there is Rupa that is not a faculty, there is Rupa that is a great element and there is Rupa that's not a great element, there is Rupa that is expressed and Rupa that is not expressed, there is Rupa that is originated by mind and there is Rupa that is not originated by mind, there is Rupa that is chitta sahabhu, born together with the mind, and there is Rupa that is not born together with mind, and so on and so forth, and so it keeps on going. And so you can see by using this method of compiling lists and then putting the lists together in different ways, you can basically keep on proliferating these lists forever, and this is essentially what the Abhidhamma method does. Okay, and this is where it gets into this. And this is specifically, this method is very characteristic of the Pali Abhidhamma. You don't find this kind of thing to nearly the same degree in the Sarvastivadin Abhidhamma or the Dharmaguptaka Abhidhamma.
Had they originally been written in Sanskrit?
Those other Abhidhammas?
Yeah. Originally.
Originally the Sarvastivada would have been in Sanskrit. Mm. the Dharmaguptaka would have probably been in Gandhari. So that's the Abhidhamma Bhajaniya. We'll have a bit more look at that method later. But here's the Panapuchaka question in the section. Again, starting here are these five khandhas. And then of these five khandhas, how many are kusala, how many are akusala, how many are undeclared? And then it goes on, it says pair, which means etc., which means we're abbreviating something. We'll show what we're abbreviating. We're actually abbreviating from another Abhidhamma book here. Okay?
How many chapters are there? Hundreds of pages or?
Billions. Yeah. And so there's kind of questions here, Bika. And then all of these ones, so there's just picking one at random. Here's the Rupa Kandho. For the form aggregate in the middle, or medium form aggregate, there are four khandhas which are inferior, and there would be one that is inferior, there would be one that's middle, and there would be one that's superior. And again, it goes on all these kinds of things. So that's not going to mean a lot right at the beginning, but I'm just going to give just a very quick impression of these texts. So just again, just to come back to the Vibhanga, the main topics, and just to sort of reinforce this idea of the Vibhanga being very closely based, the essence of it being very closely based on what we find in the sutta. So here's the Satya Vibhanga, the analysis of the truths, the Four Noble Truths, again just a bare list of them. And then on the section under Dukkha Satya, what is the noble truth of suffering? Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair are suffering. Being together with what you dislike is suffering, being separated from what you like is suffering, not getting what you want is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates of grasping are suffering. And what is birth? Whatever among those classes of beings in each of those beings in the different classes of beings is birth, conception, appearance, and birth, the manifestation of the aggregates and the appearance of the sense bases, this is called birth. Of course, this definition lifted straight out of the suttas, in Satya Vibhanga Sutta and other places. Okay? So again, just to emphasize that this book, the Vibhanga, is the basis of it is just cut and pasted more or less straight out of the sutta. But the exposition of it, the analysis of it, then takes it quite some way in different directions. Right. So is that clear? Just that basic point, is that clear?
One that you just explained. Yeah.
Right. So what I'd like to do now, that's how the Abhidhamma is has its basis in the suttas. Right. Now, what I'd like to do is show a little bit more about the specific developments that are peculiar to the Abhidhamma. And we'll have a look here. This is the critical work here is the work called the Dhammasangini. It's the first book of the Abhidhamma. And this is the first chapter in the first book. Kusala Dhamma, Akusala Dhamma, Abhyakata Dhamma. Wholesome things, wholesome Dhammas, unwholesome Dhammas, and undeclared Dhammas. Right, again. I'm not 100% sure. They must reference another part of the text. I'm not sure of that system. This is the second set of three Dhammas. Sukhaya Vedana Sampayutta Dhamma. Dhammas which are connected with pleasant feeling, dhammas which are connected with unpleasant feeling, dhammas which are connected with neither pleasant nor unpleasant feeling. Okay, so this is a set. This is what we call a madhika. All right. So let's just take it back here. So what we have here is the tika madhika. So the word madhika It's a very important word in Abhidhamma. In fact, Matika is sometimes used as a synonym for Abhidhamma, and it means exactly the same as the English word matrix. Okay? Both from the root ma, mother. And the Matika is essentially a list. Right? It's basically a list of things. Perhaps the oldest Matika might be the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas we looked at before. The Patimokkha is also referred to as a Matika in some contexts. Okay? It's a list of rules which you then explained in the Vinaya texts. Okay, so notice the similarity between the Vinaya, as we've been discussing, and then this Abhidhamma method. Yeah? Taking that Matika, that list of things taken from the suttas, from the original teachings, and then given it an explanation. It's a very similar method used in the Abhidhamma and in the Vinaya. So the Matika is a list of topics. The Tika Matika is the list of... Tika means the threes. Right? So the Tika Matika is just the list of Dhammas arranged in groups of three. And it's unfortunate they don't seem to have all this on one page. They've arranged it so that it's all on different pages. But this particular one is... this one is actually recited in Thailand. This is the funeral chant that we do. Kusala dhamma, akusala dhamma, yakata dhamma, sukhaya vedanaya sampayutta dhamma, dukkhaya vedanaya sampayutta dhamma, adukkhama sukhaya vedanaya sampayutta dhamma, vipaka dhamma, vipaka dhamma, dhamma neva vipaka na vipaka dhamma, dhamma upadin upa, and so on and so forth. So we actually do all of that at the funeral service, and it's actually quite nice because it's got a nice rhythm to it, and because he's saying Dhamma all the time, you know, it's quite reassuring. So it's got a nice thing to it. So that's particularly a Thai custom. Sorry? Yeah. Now remember, when we had a look at that brief thing before, we had that kind of funny compound here, the neva vipaka na vipaka, and here we find it again. Okay, so that was in the Vibhanga, and now in the the Dhamma Sanghani. That's not a sutta term at all, this is purely an Abhidhamma term. So what that shows is that the Vibhanga, when it's giving its Abhidhamma explanation, is relying on the Dhamma Sanghani. Okay? So the early part of the Vibhanga, okay, so remember we first looked at this book, Vibhanga Pali, the early part of it, which is the explanation according to the suttas, is basically a collection of sutta passages and then given explanations. Alright? Now the second part of it, the explanation according to the Abhidhamma, then takes the same sutta concepts and then interprets them according to the Dhamma Sanghani. Right, so the Dhamma Sanghani is very, very fundamental, and this same pattern we find repeated in several of the other books. It's very fundamental to the Pali Abhidhamma. This list of Tika Matika, the list of three Dhammas, is used again and again and again and again throughout the whole system. Right? So then that list of that Matikas goes on, and most of the topics that we find through the Matika are found also in the suttas, but they're not necessarily arranged in the same way. And so that particular Matika was a list arranged in terms of threes. Tika Matika, and then there's another Dukkha Matika. Dukkha, not Dukkha. Dukkha here meaning twos. So just pairs of things. And this was one of the controversial elements in the early Abhidhamma. Logically, you can always explain something in terms of A and not A. Right? So you can always explain it in terms of two pairs. And so this was one of the controversial questions in the early Abhidhamma period. Was should everything be explained in terms of pairs, or should you also include the threes? And the Theravadin school took the, I think, quite sensible and route of explaining in both twos and threes. And this first one is by far the most important, wholesome, unwholesome, and undeclared. And whether undeclared dhammas should be part of that was a deeply controversial issue. So could you explain every Dhamma as being wholesome and unwholesome? Or, for example, things like the mind state of an arahant, is that described as wholesome or unwholesome? Is Nibbana described as wholesome or unwholesome? These are the questions that they're asking. And so the Theravadins decided to include a third category, Avyakata, undeclared, as well as the wholesome and the unwholesome. Right. So even these little things which seem so innocuous, in fact, hide quite a degree of sort of doctrinal decisions behind how to arrange it all. So we're now going into the explanation section behind this same section. So notice how we're going through several layers of sections, and so this is where it's going to become quite complex. So we're just having a look at the first section, the explanation of kusala. Okay, so we had the first part of the Matika, wholesome, unwholesome, and undeclared. And here is the explanation of wholesome, the first one. And notice, interestingly enough, here the padabhajani. Now that's the same word that's used to describe the Vinaya. The word analysis of the rules in the Vinaya is described the same way. First question: what dhammas are wholesome? Again, notice the question and answer format. Yasmin samaye kama vacharan. So on whatever occasion pertaining to the sense sphere world, the karma loka, is a wholesome mind arises. Has arisen, that is together with joy and connected with knowledge, which is based on form, here meaning a sight, based on visual form, based on a sound, based on a smell, based on a taste, based on a touch, or based on a mental object, and whatever that is concerning, okay? So whatever that thought is about, on that occasion, there is contact, feeling, perception, intention, and mind, citta, awareness. And it goes on to list. I'll just, before I go on, I'll just explain this first one. Sorry?
I've forgotten the question. The
question was, what dhammas are wholesome? Sorry.
Welcome to Happy Dhamma.
What dhammas are wholesome? So the first thing to notice is its phrase here, yasmin samaye, on whatever occasion. Now that is a marker which indicates the purpose of the Abhidhamma. In the suttas, you always find ekan samayam, on one occasion. Yeah? And here you're saying on whatever occasion. Yeah? So what it's immediately telling us, it's decontextualized. It's not a teaching for a particular time and place. It's a teaching, it's a universal teaching. It's an abstract teaching, applies to any time and place. So that little detail is quite important. Okay, that is sense sphere. So that means it's not pertaining to form jhanas or formless jhanas. Okay, it's pertaining to the sense sphere of realm. It's a wholesome mind state that's arisen, that's. And so this is giving some qualifications for it. So wholesome mind state is associated with pleasure, right? And it's associated with knowledge, connected with knowledge. Okay, so that's also, I mean, that, to me that's quite interesting, and that's quite nice as a basic psychology. Here's like the first sentence almost of the Abhidhamma, and what it's telling you is that wholesome mind states are associated with joy and they're associated with insight. Yeah? So this somanasa is like the emotional connotation of it, is happiness, and the cognitive side of it is that it's associated with knowledge. Okay, so this is that's quite a nice little starting point there. Then it says, now on that occasion, so this has arisen, this wholesome state of mind has arisen, okay, and it's telling you on that occasion, what else is there? What's going on? Right, so it's trying to explain what's actually happening on that occasion. So this tasmin samaye refers back to this yasmin samaye. On whatever occasion, blah blah blah, on that occasion there is contact, there is feeling, there is perception, there is intention, jetana, and there is citta, there is the mind. Okay, so this is a list of mental factors that are present. And notice that this list of mental factors is very similar to the mental factors found that are the definition of nama in the suttas, except nama has manasikara instead of chitta here. Okay. What else is present? Vitaka is present, vichara is present, piti is present, rapture is present, bliss is present, and one-pointedness is present. Okay, these are, of course, the five jhana factors. Right? So, again, we don't want to be in a rush to interpret this, okay, too quickly. What's the implications of this? But what it's suggesting is that, according to the Abhidhamma system of analysis, that all of those five factors, which are characteristic of the first jhana, are in fact present, even if in a weak form, at every moment of wholesome consciousness. Okay? Is that clear? This again becomes controversial. This is, becomes one of the bases for the whole idea of Kanaka Samadhi and the presence of concentration in every form. Yeah. So, but anyway, just for now, just to notice that that's what it seems to be saying. Perhaps it's not. Perhaps it's saying something else and it needs more interpretation. But and that's just one suggested interpretation here. But it is interesting to notice that it's the start of the analysis. It starts with those familiar lists which are taken from the suttas. And so this suggests that these things like the jhana factors and the factors under nama were the roots of this whole method of analysing mind states in terms of the mental factors that are present. Okay? So just to notice that this is what it's actually trying to do here. Okay, so then it keeps on going on. The faculty of faith is present, the faculty of energy is present, the faculty of mindfulness is present, the faculty of samadhi is present, the faculty of wisdom is present. So that's the five spiritual faculties. But then it goes on to list a few more faculties. The faculty of mind is present, the faculty of joy is present, and the faculty of life is present. So these are other things which are called indriyas, called faculties in the suttas, but they're not included in this same list of five faculties. So we see this tendency to conglomerate things which are taken from the suttas and put them into one list. And so in a sense you're losing the shape of the original list. The original list of five faculties has a structure. Yeah, faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi and wisdom. It has a kind of structure. And now when you append these other three things on here, sort of loses its structure, loses its form. So this is, you just see that sort of, on the one hand, the maintenance of things from the suttas, and on the other hand, gradual introduction of new ways of seeing things. The next list, there is right view, there is right intention, there is right effort, there is right mindfulness, there is right concentration. So all the factors of the path, except for the middle factors, which are the factors relating to sila, okay? And I think that they're excluded because they're not exclusively mental things. Okay? And then it goes on the various powers, spiritual powers. Again, five spiritual powers we meet frequently in the suttas: faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. The faculty of conscience and shame and conscience, hiri and otapa. And again, the same thing going on here. Taking a standard sutta list and appending a couple of extra powers that are mentioned in the suttas, but not part of that same list in the suttas. Then it goes to list another bunch of things. Alobo hoti. There is non-greed present. Adoso hoti. There is non-anger. There is non-delusion present. There is non-covetousness. There is non-ill will. There is right view present. Now, this then starts to raise a few questions. When you say there is non-greed present, does that actually mean that there is something in the mind called non-greed, or does it just mean that greed is absent? Yeah? So again, that's the kind of a philosophical discussion that could go on about that. Another thing that's arising here is that, for example, it says amoha. Now, amoha means non-delusion and could be taken as a synonym for wisdom. Right? But we've already got the spiritual faculty of wisdom. We've always already got right view as a path factor of wisdom. We've already got the spiritual power as a wisdom. and now we have non-delusion. So what's going on here? Are these separate faculties or qualities of mind, or are these synonyms with just different terms? And so again, this is one of the questions which the Abhidhamma addresses itself to. Okay? It addresses it later on, yeah. And again, so all of these things will go through their own system. So it'll systematically list all of these things, compare them one with the other.
So it invents new ways of looking at things and then creates questions for it.
Yeah, but they're not
self-perpetuating.
It's a self-generating system. Yeah, but the questions themselves may or may not be useful.
Mm.
I mean, obviously you can spin it out to absurdity, but that's not an unreasonable question. Is samadhi in the Eightfold Path really the same thing as panya in the spiritual faculties, for example? Mm. You know, that's not a meaningless question by any means. Absolutely, yeah. Remembering that this is, you know, this is intended for people already grounded on the suttas, you know? So
It's
not meant to be an introductory text, no. So the next of the list, so there is bodily tranquility, and this is interpreted later on as meaning body doesn't mean the physical body, but it means the mental factors. There is mental tranquility, there is physical lightness, and mental lightness, there is physical pliability, and mental pliability, physical workability, and mental workability, physical bhaganyuta. Similar kind of meaning, physical flexibility or something like that, mental flexibility, physical or bodily uprightness, and mental uprightness. There is sati and sampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension. There is samatha and vipassana. There is paggaha. I'm not quite sure what it means. I think it might mean... I don't know what happens to a paggaha. Avikepa is non-scattered mind. Okay? Now, so that's the list. It's gone down there now. And then it finishes all this. So this is answering the question, what dhammas are kusala? And here it says, these dhammas are kusala. And then this final one is very important. Yeva pana tasming samaye, or whatever, on that occasion, other, dependently originated, formless dhammas, okay, these dhammas are wholesome. Alright? So we've had a list of wholesome dhammas, but the text at the end quite clearly says yeva pananye. So this phrase yeva pananye is a very important one. It means or whatever else. Alright? What that means is that this text, the Dhammasangani, is not giving us a comprehensive list of everything that's wholesome dhammas. It's giving us a partial list and saying these are the kinds of things which are wholesome dhammas, or whatever else that's dependently originated and arises at that time, that is also wholesome. Okay? So when in any, what the point of this is that any moment of wholesome consciousness, all of the mental factors which are associated with that wholesome consciousness are also themselves wholesome. Alright, is that clear? Now then it comes down here and it starts to define each one of the terms that we've met above in that list. Okay, so then on that occasion, what is contact? It's one of the first factors we met. Now, on that, whatever on that occasion is contact, touching, contacting, and contactedness, something like that. These are just different formations from the same root of pasa. Just a list of synonyms. These are quite artificial, abstractive forms. What is feeling? Vedana, whatever, on that occasion. Tajamano vinyana dhatu sampasa jantetasikam sata. Okay, so here we're introducing some more technical terminology. So what this says is, whatever, on that occasion, is a mental factor, jetasika, which is born of contact through the which is born of contact through the appropriate mind consciousness element. Right? Okay. So basically it means whatever mental factor at that point. Okay, so don't worry about the technical terminology too much. Whatever mental factor at that point is pleasing, okay, is pleasurable, sukha, and has mental contact which is pleasurable and is felt as pleasing, something like that. So this is called Vedana. So again, just finding what is Vedana, and then similarly with Sanya, whatever is Sanya, Sanjana, Sanjani Tata. So this is one of the things about the Abhidhamma, is that it doesn't, the Dhamma Sangini doesn't really provide us with particularly useful definitions for a lot of things. So here the definition of Sanya, again it's just three verbal variations on Sanya. Yeah? And Vedana is the same, so it's not actually telling us a whole lot about these things. It's down here when it defines Chitta. Let's have a look at a more interesting one. Okay, so here's Vitakka. Okay, more interesting. Okay, so here's Piti or rapture. Right? Now, whatever on that occasion is rapture, gladness, amodana, which is again gladness, pamodana, gladness, haso is like laughing or joy, pahaso, strong laughing and joy, viti, I'm not familiar with viti, must mean the same thing, odagyam, again I'm not familiar with that, atamanata is pleasedness of the mind, then this is that rapture. So this is giving us some terms which are actually found in the suttas. So for example, pamoja is a term found in the sutta. Atamana is the word which is used at the end of every sutta and says the bhikkhus were pleased with that discourse. So what this is telling us is that these are just different words for the same thing. Okay, so it's acting like a thesaurus. It's one of the purposes that it has. Virya, sati, and so it gives us a whole list of synonyms for all of these different kinds of things. And so, say, a long list here, the synonyms for panya. Right. So this is, again, how the Abhidhamma is working.
So which are the parts that the traditions that find Abhidhamma useful that they actually use?
Rarely do they actually certainly in modern times, rarely do you find people actually teaching the canonical texts that we've got here. So what they teach is the later Abhidhamma works. Yeah. And so the kinds of analysis that they present are actually quite different to what we're reaching here. But basically the thing that I think people find useful is that the Abhidhamma gives a sort of a degree of clarity in terms of investigating different mental states and what's present or absent in different mental states. Okay, so it gives you some clarity in that. So I won't go too much further here in the Dhamma Sangini, but this is really the fundamental Pali Abhidhamma book. But I'll just briefly refer to a couple of other ones. Now you see, this other book we got down here, the Yamaka, has a whole long list of things. This is actually just one book. And then the Patthana is even further. And the Patthana is quite an extraordinary book. It's perhaps one of the most exotic creations of human consciousness. And
these were all of those were originally oral literature.
Oral texts. Yep.
Amazing.
Yep. Quite extraordinary, yeah. Now this is the first paragraph of the Patthana. Now Patthana is the last book of the Abhidhamma. Right? And seven books of the Pali Abhidhamma. The first one we looked at, Dhamma Sangini, is the first, Patana is the last. And it has its own Matika. And the Matika goes, He tu patsayo aram, and if we're going to do it funeral chants as well, aram anapatsayo adhipati patsayo anantara patsayo samanantara patsayo. And it's a nice one to chant again. And usually, you know, when you do it at funerals, if they're not dead yet, they certainly will be by then. And so this, that's just a list of different kinds of conditions. Pachaya means condition, and these are lists of different kinds of conditions. And then they're given a brief definition in the next form. What is hetu pachaya? And this means hetu, root, means the whatever root, whatever hetu connected, whatever dhamma is connected with the root that originated from form. That is called by means of the root condition. That's a bit meaningless, but basically it means the greed, hatred, and delusion as the origination for things, and non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. Second one, aramana pachaya, is the sense objects as conditions for the relevant sense consciousness. Adhipati pachaya is the four idhipadas, chanda, virya, citta, vimansa, as condition for the dhammas which arise along with them. It's called adhipati pachaya. Anantara pachaya, and so on and so forth, and it gives definitions for each one of these. So they're relatively straightforward definitions for each of those 24 conditions. So the fact that there's 24 is probably like a doubling of the dependent origination is 12, and so they kind of doubled that and ended up with 24. Some of them are just synonymous, they don't really need to be 24. So that's the Matika of the Dhammas, of the Patana. Now then, that takes that Matika and then combines that in every possible way with the other Matikas from the Dhammasangani and every factor in that. Okay? So you can get an idea of the complexity that's involved. We kind of give one list of Dhammas of what's kusala, yeah, and under what's wholesome. We then have that whole long list of what's wholesome, pasa and so on and so on and so forth. And we can now take that list and apply that to every one of the factors within the Dhamma Sangani, and then apply it to two factors. So you can apply two factors at one time, and then three factors at one time, and then four factors, and then you can turn it all upside down, and then you can apply them all together, and you end up with estimated that there's several hundred billion questions found in the Patana. Okay? So this book, the Patana, has never actually been manifested in actual living reality. Okay? If you printed it out, I worked once, if you printed it out, the book would be so wide, it would go halfway from Sydney to Melbourne. Huh? This is just a random page here. And see what we've got on here. So you keep on going through this stuff. There's a massive amount of text that we've got here. It's not actually giving me anything, it's just abbreviated everything. So each one of these links I've just gone through is you know, something that's to be expanded. And then here it goes, unwholesome, defilement connected dhammas, dependent on what is unwholesome, defilement connected dhammas arises dependent on the root condition. That's in brief. Okay? And there is one by means of root, and there is one by means of object, and so on and so forth, and goes through the rest of them in brief. And then all of these other ones, it says, take these all at once. So this is all abbreviating. So even in this huge text, which we've got here on the online version, it's still abbreviating every bit. And so then it says, wholesome, defilement, separated, dhammas, dependent. What is wholesome, defilement, separated, dhammas, arises due to the root condition, wholesome, defilement, separated, dhammas, dependent, what is undeclared, so here's the undeclared from the Dhammasangani, separated from the defilements, dhammas, arises by the root condition, wholesome, separated from defilements, dhammas, arisen, wholesome, defilement, dhammas, so far it's separated and mute and undeclared dhammas originated by means of the root condition. Okay? So this is, we've got the unwholesome, wholesome, and then wholesome and undeclared, and then it combines wholesome and undeclared. And then it goes on. Unwholesome, defilement separated dhammas dependent on undeclared, defilement separated dhammas arises by means of head to root condition. Undeclared, defilement separated dhammas dependent on what is undeclared, defilement separated dhammas arise by means of the root condition. Wholesome, defilement separated, undeclared, and so on and so forth, and on it goes for literally thousands and thousands and thousands, if not millions, of pages. So as I said, this is perhaps one of the most extraordinary works ever to have emerged from human consciousness. One, it's literally, I mean, it's like the pyramids. It's like you look at it and you go, why? Obviously it meant something to somebody somehow, but yeah. Okay, so this is just a very brief look at some of the things that we tend to find in the Pali Abhidhamma. To look at the other Abhidhammas, anyone who's interested, that is the best book, possibly because it's the only book which actually does a comparative study of the different Abhidhamma systems, Eric Frauwohner. And he does a brief analysis of all of the Pali Abhidhamma books, as well as the Sarvastivadin and Sharif and the Dharmaguptaka Abhidhamma. The important finding that he finds in here is that one of these Abhidhamma books, which is in fact the the Vibhanga, which we looked at first, shares common roots both with the Sarvastivadin book called the Dharmaskanda and a Dharmaguptaka work called the Shariputra Abhidharma. So all of the early Abhidhamma systems that we know of share this common work. Okay? And that's based on that what we call the Samyutta Matika, the list of topics from the Samyutta. And there's certain literary peculiarities about the work which are shared between each of those three, which shows quite clearly, quite indisputably, that they must have a common origin. All right? Mm-hmm. So the way they've been developed in existing texts is quite different, but there must be a common root to these three books. And so this again underlies the importance of that as the roots of the Buddhist Abhidhamma systems. And so, for example, the Dharmaguptaka work, the Shariputra Abhidharma, has a, as well as that list of topics from the Samyutta, also has various other categories which are similar to the Dhammasangani, and also the Patthana, the one we're just looking at now, it has the list of conditions. This has 10 conditions, whereas the Pali version has 24. So the Pali is more highly developed in that respect. So this is this one. Now, if you want to get a fairly straightforward survey of the Abhidhamma Pitaka, the Pali Abhidhamma Pitaka, then this is a good one. This is Jnanatiloka's book, Guide Through the Abhidhamma Pitaka. Okay, so that's kind of an excellent little summary of the whole of the canonical Abhidhamma. Right? So he's a German monk, he's gone back to the canonical Abhidhamma. And for more reflective essays about the Abhidhamma, okay, then this is, again, this is an excellent work, this is Jnanaponika's Abhidhamma Studies. And so here he's taken much more of a reflective approach to sort of trying to investigate certain aspects of the Abhidhamma and the meaning of it. One of the things that he points to in this book, and I think is quite true, if you remember when we looked at the suttas on dependent origination just the other day, one of the suttas we looked at made this very fundamental distinction between dependent origination and then dependently originated dhammas. Remember that? And so the dependent origination was like the matrix of conditions. Dependently originated dhammas is the actual phenomena that arise in that matrix. So it's like the things and the connections between the things. That's a very simple way of thinking about it. And what Nyanaponika points out is that that pattern is also maintained in the Theravada and Abhidhamma system, because the first book, the Dhamma Sangani, is essentially about the things that there are. So what we saw there, a list of dhammas, right? A list of different mental factors and physical factors and so on. So it's mainly about the things, whereas the Patthana is mainly about the connections between those things. Okay? And so that whole Abhidhamma system actually has a structure to it, where it starts out talking about and analysing and listing all the phenomena that appear in the world, and then the Patthana concerns itself in great detail with all the different ways that those things are interconnected. But as you can see, the actual canonical texts, because of their extremely terse and opaque style, are basically impossible to read, and always have been. Right? It's not because cultural changes or anything like that. They've always been basically unreadable texts. Not all of them, especially like the Patthana and so on. And so this is why in the post-canonical period then there came this sort of movement to sort of compile these and arrange them in a more kind of readable, more usable form. Now in the Pali tradition, the sort of the great outcome of that, of course, was what we call the Visuddhimagga. And the Visuddhimagga is not explicitly an Abhidhamma work, right? But practically speaking, it is. And so practically speaking, it compiles the Abhidhamma system, the main outlines of the Abhidhamma system as presented in the Pali tradition at that time. And of course that's complemented by the various commentaries on the Abhidhamma. And similar things were happening in all of the schools of Buddhism. So within the Sarvastivadin school, let's say I have a list here, of Abhidhamma texts. Now I mentioned that the Sarvastivadin ones exist in Chinese translation. They're not found in Tibetan or Sanskrit. And they have a list of 7 Abhidhamma works, which is kind of interesting. Both the Pali and the Sarvastivadin have 7 Abhidhamma works, and they have certain things in common. One of the differences being that according to the Sarvastivadin tradition, all of the Abhidhamma works were compiled by disciples. Okay? So according to the Theravadins, claim that the Buddha spoke the Abhidhamma, whereas the Sarvastivadins more reasonably attribute them to various disciples. So the at the end of the canonical period, so we're talking about, say, the beginning of the Christian era, the common era, then these shastras began to be composed in all of the schools. They started to put together these shastras. And there are various generations of these, and the ones which are the most, or have been the most influential down to modern times, were composed about the 4th century. Particularly one called the Abhidharma Kosha by Vasubandhu is probably the most influential Abhidharma treatise in Buddhist history, and is still widely studied in Tibet and in China. Unfortunately, we don't have a copy of that here. It has had a good translation into English. Unfortunately, we don't have that. But here we have another one, less well known, but also quite important one, by Asanga. Asanga was Vasubandhu's brother. He's also writing about 4th century or so. And this is called the Abhidharma Samuchaya, the compendium of the Abhidhamma. And this was translated into French by Walpola Rahula, who's well known as the author of What the Buddha Taught. And so this is Asanga belonged to the Yogacara school, and so this is a sort of an Abhidhamma from the Yogacara perspective. But I actually quite like this one, and I find it quite useful because it's not too extreme. It doesn't give, you know, those really outrageous kind of long lists and combinations and things like that, but it gives more kind of pertinent and fairly brief descriptions of things according to this particular Abhidhamma system. So just to find a random passage from here. Of some interest. Okay, so here's a definition. It's the list of mental factors. Okay, so we saw that in the Dhammasangani, right? Hang on. In the Dhammasangani, when it listed the mental factors and it gave definitions of them, it tended to give just definitions which were just verbal variants of the original word. It didn't really, or just synonyms. It didn't give us a lot of information about it. Now here in the Abhidharma Samuchaya, it's giving us a list of mental factors and giving an explanation for them. And I'll just read out a few of them. This is just a random page, just to give an idea of the kind of things that it talks about. What is anger? It is mental malevolence which forms part of repugnance caused by a present prejudice. Its function consists of supplying a basis to violence and the use of weapons and sticks, etc. Right? There's a definition of anger. So that's fair enough, isn't it?
Pretty good.
Yeah? What is rancor? Not sure what rancor means in English, but anyway, upanaha. Not subsequently abandoning the intention of revenge. Yeah? Which also forms part of repugnance. Its function consists of supplying a basis to impatience. Right? What is hypocrisy? It is the fact of hiding one's own faults when one has been justly accused, which forms part of delusion, moha. Its function consists of supplying a basis to a state of remorse and uneasiness. What is malice? Mental malevolence forming part of repugnance preceded by anger and rancor. Its function consists of supplying a basis to violent, harsh and insulting words, to an accumulation of demerit and a state of uneasiness. What is envy? It is an angry thought in him who desires gains and honours. It is part of hatred aroused by intolerance for the welfare of others. Its function consists of arousing affliction and a state of uneasiness. And so on. So these are the kinds of definitions which Asanga is giving here. So I think, you know, from that you can see that it's definitely more useful and quite reasonable. And, you know, you can see that this kind of text has a genuine purpose. Yeah, you reach and you come to a word in the sutta. What does that mean? So part of it functions just to be a dictionary. Yeah, and I don't understand that word. And what is it? Oh, okay, this is what it's talking about. And so you can kind of study that. Yeah.
Fascinated that these two brothers
will
throw
fish. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would that be really different if they are? Or, yeah. Or, yeah. Well, it's like a lot of interesting history done on that. Quite a lot of scholarly contention. And the general story goes, I think Asanga was the older brother and became quite early on, he may have originated in the Mahishasika school, I'm not certain, but he early on converted to Yogacara, and then he wrote this work called the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra, And it was kind of disparaged. I'm not sure if it was disparaged by his brother or someone else who said, you know, how can this school be any good if you have to carry the philosophical system around on the back of an elephant? So the Yogacara Bhumishastra was quite a large treatise. And so he Asanga tends to be much more very, very systematic. He explains everything very patiently in great detail as he comes to it. Yeah? And Asanga was probably, or certainly was influential on Buddhaghosa. Buddhaghosa actually took some of his explanations of the Bodhisattva's path and other things from Asanga. Okay? Now the actual relationship between the two of them has not been investigated in detail, but there's certainly some influence there. Vasubandhu was the younger brother, and it was said that when they were learning together that Vasubandhu would always understand on the first explanation and Asanga would require two or three explanations. Yeah? But Asanga became convinced of the Yogacara early on and kept trying to convince his brother to adopt the Yogacara school, and Vasubandhu was very reluctant. And it seems that he started out in the Sarvasivadins and then drifted away to a more critical point of view of the Sarvasivadins, and because the great story about that was when he was invited by the Sarvasivadin Sangha Bhadra, who was one of the Kashmiri Sarvasivadins, to write a treatise summarising the Abhidharma. So he wrote this treatise called the Abhidharma Kosha, and it's a very brief, it's a bit like the Abhidharma to Sangaha, something like that. It's a very kind of brief summary of the Abhidharma system, and he sent this to Sangha Bhadra, and Sangha Bhadra wrote back to him and said, "Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu, it's a wonderful treatise. Thank you so much for explaining this. It's a fantastic work, but it's very dense and it's very short. Can you write us your own commentary to explain it?" Okay? And so he wrote his commentary, and in his commentary, he deliberately refuted all of the Sarvasivadin views. And so he wrote this, and then he sent it back to Sangha Bhadra, and Sangha Bhadra was completely outraged and furious with Vasubandhu. And Sangha Bhadra's comment was, he described Vasubandhu as that, what is it, that heretical that heretic whose ravings have all the coherence of a mad deaf mute in a fever dream. And Vasubandhu's comment on Sangabhadra was that he always knew the right thing to say in an argument, but he didn't have good deep wisdom. So then,
what deep year were they?
About 418. Yeah. So then Vasubandhu drifted to South Frantica. Later on, it seems he was converted by his brother Asanga to Yogacara. And when he was converted, he became so infatuated with it that he read the whole of the Prajnaparamita literature in one go while sitting in a tub of sesame oil. So it is said. It's pretty intense. And they're quite, yeah, different in some ways. Again, as I said, Asanga's things that's very clear, quite very comprehensive. He's got this encyclopedic kind of way about him, whereas Vasubandhu is much more of a problem solver. He's much more analytical and critical, and he sort of tends to go, he's very brief and very terse. We've got a book downstairs, The Seven Works of Vasubandhu, which is really excellent and gives a great insight into his way of thinking. So that's a very, very quick overview of the Abhidharma tradition. Now one of the things that happened with this tradition, and we'll talk about this next week when we have a look at Nagarjuna. Now you can see you've got this kind of thing of the first book here called the Dhamma Sangani, and we've had these lists of dhammas, right? And it always says this dhamma is or this dhamma is not. And so the question of what is a dhamma, and in what sense is a dhamma, what does it mean, became critical at the end and after the end of the canonical period. Okay? And so what you had emerging in that post-canonical period is this idea of a dhamma which said Atanopanasabha. Dharam. Oops. Dharma. And this, interestingly enough, is found in a similar way in different schools. But the meaning of this is basically a definition. What is a Dhamma? It bears, so the root is dhareti. So that's actually the verbal root of the word Dhamma, is to bear something or to hold something. Okay, so it bears its own, its atta, okay, sabhava. And so the word sabhava, in Sanskrit, is swabhava. Its own or itself essence. Or existence is from the root bhava, to be. So the meaning of this is that a Dhamma is something which has its own self-essence. Okay, it exists in and of itself. This is the definition of a Dhamma which is given by the Abhidhamma schools, both the Theravadan school and also the Sarvastivadan school. Now, of course, here we're getting into quite problematic or difficult territory as far as philosophically is concerned. What is a Dhamma? Does a Dhamma exist in and of itself? And so as soon as you get the word atta appearing here, then Buddhists start to get nervous. Right? We've got a self is creeping in the back door. Right? These things really, truly, really exist. What do you mean when you say these things exist? And so this starts to become an issue, and this became the dominant philosophical problem of the early middle period of Buddhism. So we're now talking about the first centuries AD. Okay, after the post-canonical period, they started coming up with these definitions. Probably this definition emerged in the Sarvastivadin school and spread out from there, I think. But so this statement and this idea is what Nagarjuna and the Prajnaparamita came along to criticize. A dhamma, any kind of dhamma, contact, feeling, perception, mind, consciousness, they're all dhammas. And so do they exist? Or do they not exist? In what sense do you mean they exist?
I think that was just the question that
they find. That's right, yeah. Because you're talking, the Abhidhamma is talking about dhammas all the time. This dhamma and that dhamma and the other dhamma and the other dhamma. Well, what actually is a dhamma? What do you mean when you call something a dhamma? So the Abhidhamma itself didn't really discuss that problem. Okay, just used the word dhammas and you just got an idea of it from the context. But then after the Abhidhamma, it started asking, well, what is dhamma? What does it mean? More of a feeling of, you know, like in the suttas, you know, somebody comes to see the Buddha and they actually have a problem which is relevant for their life. You know, my son's died, you know, what am I going to do about it? You know, so you have these things. Whereas the Abhidhamma, you get much more of a feeling, you know, a bunch of guys, and, you know, I hate to say this, but I don't think the Bhikkhunis had a big hand in evolving the Abhidhamma. Bunch of guys sitting around in a kind of in a very rarefied intellectual environment, yeah, where they had a lot of time to sit around and discuss these very abstruse points, which basically nobody else really understood, you know, and obviously they'd be sitting there and once, obviously the villagers they'd go for alms to wouldn't have a clue what they're talking about, yeah. So you're seeing the development of this very kind of esoteric intellectual culture, yeah. And that, you know, in the end, that may have been one of the things which destroyed Buddhism in India. Because they, you know, in Nalanda and these places, you had these kind of universities. We had these incredibly erudite, and, you know, and that marks, and it was what it meant. But they really seemed to lose contact with the villagers and with the people that were around them. At least, that's another one of the criticisms which the Mahayana texts make of the Abhidhamma movement. So you should always remember when you're reading Mahayana sutras, that essentially when the Mahayana Sutras are criticizing what they call Hinayana and the Hinayanists, basically what they mean is the Sarvastivadin Abhidharmakas. That's really what they're talking about. Okay? They're talking about those, and yeah, most of the time that's what they're referring to. And so, you know, you can see that critiques emerging. For example, one sutta called the Sandhya Nirmochana Sutra, Mahayana Yogacara Sutra of about the 3rd century. And it has, I can't remember who the protagonist is now, but he says, here I was sitting meditation in the morning in my forest monastery, and I get up and I walked into the town, and then I went into the, and I saw in the city, and there the monks were sitting around and they were arguing about the khandhas and the origination and the dissolution and the factors of them and the characteristics of them, and they're arguing about the sense bases and dependent origination and the Four Noble Truths and all those dhammas that we found in the Samyutta Matika. It gives, yeah? They're arguing about all these things and their conditions and their factors and their qualities, and none of them had any true insight into the Dhamma. Yeah? And so that's, you know, that's that kind of critique which was brought to that that project.
So what's the time period of the Vajrapaṇita?
Usually placed about the beginning of the Common Era, so say 500 years after the Buddha. Yeah. May have had roots slightly earlier than that, but that's basically around that period. Yeah. So of course, you know, just from a, this is one of the reasons, of course, why we're so confident that the Mahayana Sutras were later, because, you know, when we look at them, what they're criticizing quite explicitly and quite clearly are these Abhidhamma doctrines, and anybody who's familiar with the Abhidhamma would immediately recognize, oh, that's what they're talking about. You know, just one obvious example here is, say, the Heart Sutra, which in the Chinese version of the Heart Sutra, it says Avalokiteshvara was coursing in the profound doctrine of the Prajnaparamita, and he said to Sariputta,
This is the Heart Sutra,
he said to Sariputta, form is not self, or so form is empty. Oh, these five khandhas are empty. Is that right? From the five,
says,
the
five aggregates. It says form.
But even before that, we haven't even.
The same is true of forms, feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness.
Yeah, we haven't even got to that bit yet.
Oh, sorry, before.
In the introduction, he's talking to Sariputta, and he says, these five khandhas are empty.
Oh, yes, sorry.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's
five khandhas are empty.
Before,
yeah. Now,
the same is true of forms, feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness.
Yeah. So the five, so here it is, his Avalokiteshvara practicing the profound Prajna Paramita, and he looked down and saw that these five aggregates, Panchaskanda, are empty. But he doesn't actually say that they're empty, and this is the Sanskrit text which is not translated properly in the Chinese. It actually says they're Swabhava Shunya. Yeah? Swabhava, they're empty of swabhava, empty of inherent existence.
Yes, I think sometimes it gets misinterpreted because of that.
Yeah.
It means empty of a permanent existing existence, yeah.
Exactly, and that's the critique. And this is specifically an Abhidhamma term. You don't find that term at all in the suttas, and not even in the canonical Abhidhamma, only in the post-canonical Abhidhamma literature. So this, you know, as soon as we see this, we know that this is actually a critique of those kinds of Abhidhamma systems. But then having done that, it then goes through the five khandhas, it goes through eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, it goes through the various kinds of dhatus and the dependent origination, the same things as we found in the Samyutta Matika. And it says that all of them are empty of inherent existence. And so that's like a summary of that critique of the Abhidhamma system.
It's interesting when it talks to Sariputta, who would Theravada and the
monk
responsible for the Abhidhamma treatise. Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, and not just in the Theravada, but in the In the other schools as well, yeah, he's always regarded as one of the fathers of the Abhidhamma. So here he sort of stands for the representative of the Abhidhamma tradition. Yeah, so here, Sariputta, form is emptiness. Emptiness is just form. Form is not different from emptiness, and form is not different. Emptiness is not different from form. What is form? That is emptiness. What is emptiness? That is form. And the same for feeling, perception, sankharas, and consciousness. And so here, Sariputta, all dhammas are characteristic of emptiness and not arisen, not ceased, not.
Not pure, not tainted.
Not pure, not tainted, exactly. Not deficient and not full. So this one is not arisen and not ceased is also quite interesting. This one is also used by Nagarjuna. And in Buddhaghosa, in his discussion of dependent origination, sort of starts it out by saying, and herein, those who say not arisen and not ceased are wrong. That's a pretty straightforward position on that one. So anyway, so that's just to give you some, just a very, very brief introductory survey of the Abhidhamma literature and the Abhidhamma project. So notice we didn't touch on the later developments in the Pali Abhidhamma, such as the, which are found in the Abhidhamma Sangha, like the series of 17 mind moments and all of these kinds of things. So that's part of the later tradition. So remember in the Dhamma Sangani it said Yeva Pananya or whatever else. In the Pali tradition it filled all of those things in. Okay, so it listed every one. And so you ended up with a list of, I think it's 52 mental factors and 129 kinds of consciousness, kinds of citta. And all of those were sort of analysed and brought into the system. You know what I mean when I talk about the 17 moments of 17 mind moments? Chitta vritti? Do you want to know?
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good one to see in a diagram. I'm not sure chitta vritti.
Oops. Is it one of the moments of past consciousness or something?
Past consciousness is part of it, but
it's like at the end, a little black circle.
Chitta vritti is a general thing, but it can. That's right, yeah. That's right, yeah. I'm just trying to see if. Whether it has diagram of it. It's actually not the basic idea of it is not that complex, but it's just to give you an idea. Yeah. Where would it be?
Karuk.
Let's go Karuk. So this is the system which we found pretty much in the Visuddhimagga, although not so emphasised there, but really developed and emphasised in the Abhidhamma Sangha and later literature. Do you know whereabouts in the book it is?
About 3 quarters of the way through.
That's good, yeah. 200-page book.
Yeah, you've got it. It gets on the list of things we've got in there.
It's a chart.
It's a chart, where's that?
Above. covenant somewhere.
Oh, yeah, list of charts. Where's my name?
So that's.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the mind door cognitive process, page 253-13. Beautiful. Yeah, 213 is a table page. This is the eye door cognitive process. Yeah. So this is the basic idea. So the basic idea is that you have at each moment that we call consciousness is comprised of a number of different events, each one of which is called a citta, and each citta consists of performs different functions. And so he has just analysed it in the various different forms, material base of it. So this is the eye door. This is an example of what happens, for example, when you see something. So the minimal fraction of seeing things, and the eye is actually extremely sensitive. I think actually, if you're totally sensitized to the dark, you can actually see one photon. I think I read that somewhere. So you can actually see your actual eye becomes. So this is just like that one minimal event of eye consciousness. And so here, all these things, object, what is the object of the consciousness, and there's a kind of consciousness, blah, blah, blah. So you start out here, life, this is Bhavanga. That means this is just the continuum of just the ordinary, it's just what's going on, just the basic level of consciousness, nothing much happening. And so this is just a series of them, an undetermined number of Bhavanga chittas. And then you have past life continuum, Atita Bhavanga, trembling life continuum. Okay, the Bhavanga is beginning to tremble, beginning to something's beginning to happen to it, and then the Bhavanga is cut off here. Okay, so this is the Bhavanga process is ending.
Is that when you die?
Then Bhavanga. No. This is just an ordinary moment of sense consciousness. So anytime you just see anything. That means, yeah, the next one is the eye process of visual consciousness is about to start. Yeah?
So this is a, those grey bits on the left are just sort of waiting for something to happen.
Exactly.
Resting, waiting to start,
yeah. And then this trembling bit, I mean, that's like you kind of, you're starting to hear the footsteps coming towards the door, right? And then you have the pancha dwara vajana is turning towards the door. Okay? So you're not yet seeing anything, but your mind is turning towards the...
So are your eyes closed at this stage?
It doesn't matter whether your eyes are open or closed.
Scary
part. But you're not seeing anything.
I see. So it's complete blackness. Yeah. Somehow, whether your eyes are closed or not.
The scary part is that your eyes are climbing towards the door before the contact actually occurs.
Right.
Yeah.
And the eye is okay. So then,
is that sense doors?
Sense doors, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the five doors. So they're turning towards.
I thought
sense
there,
doors, yeah.
There was actual door.
Sense doors.
Sorry to be so literal.
No, that's fine. True Theravada beating that out of
your. In What the Believer, they do mention this concept of the, like a baseball player, that the arms are moving before the visual process has actually gone through and determined where the ball will be in space, and the arms are already starting to move.
Yeah.
And how is that possible?
When I played cricket, I didn't usually have any idea when the ball was until I was out.
Couldn't that be explained by that the mind is inclined that way due to past karmic experience?
Yeah.
So your karmic consciousness, because you've hit the ball many times, you don't necessarily need to have that engage in that present moment because you have a memory of it. that engages the moment first.
I think neuroscientists and someone say there's some that you, before you move your arm, it's going on and the neurons are firing in your brain. No, no, it's the other way around. It's the other way around.
Because
your arm moves before the neurons start firing in your brain. Mm.
But it depends on what.
Yeah.
So isn't the mind a four hour of reflections?
It's
just so fast that you're in this.
Mind is different to brain.
Yeah.
The brain is
like. Yeah, so
then
your mind is
just
brain.
Maybe there's a distinction.
There's also a reflex.
The reflex
doesn't
work.
Yeah,
it's
yeah. If you go watch that, what the bleep, it's just
Well, what the bleeps? Not exactly.
Not exactly cutting edge science, but
we
except for the bits which are channeled from Seth.
Which also then gives rise to other questions about, like for example, from a physiological point of view, it's also proven that certain motor functions are not actually associated with higher order thinking functions.
Yeah.
They're actually processed in the spinal cord, not in the brain.
Yeah, reflexes.
Yeah.
So I think mind is, the physical basis of the mind is not limited to the brain, but it's dispersed throughout the whole body. But those things like the baseball thing, that's explainable in a number of different ways. I think you've got, for someone who's an expert, They've got muscle memory of all of those things, and that would be picking up all of these subconscious cues just from the posture of the guy, throwing the ball. They would be picking up his attitude, how he's moving. You've seen him do this hundreds of times before, so you kind of.
But in terms of, looking at that from a Buddhist perspective, couldn't that, as I mentioned before, just be explained away by the concept of karmic consciousness? That if you've experienced this before, that'll be laid down in your memory, which becomes your your
comfort level. In three dimensional space, you know it's going to be in front of you somewhere.
Yeah.
To tell you exactly. Like we're talking about the creme de la creme baseball players hitting home runs. We're not talking about somebody slogging away strike. How does that memory manifest as a hit?
But I think it's right in the sense that we, Chomsky's theory of linguistics, he believed that it's impossible for infants to learn language because it's too complex. Yeah, and so this, a lot of these things I think are pre-programmed and learnt through past lives. I don't know if it's specific that thing, but the general idea that the motor reactions and things are there. Yeah. So just.
When we hear something dark and it's no big sound, it's triggering a different kind of imagination and feeling and all these thoughts. I'm thinking probably the old imagination that just come up and feel like it comes from past experiences.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, but you can actually, recall that.
Yeah.
That's the only part that I can probably say could be that kind of.
But mind can also see the future as well. And so if you can see the future, you just tell the mind informs the brain of what's going to happen very quickly, and then the muscles will start to move before the ball gets there. The future is
incredible. Anyway, let's have a look quickly at this process, okay? So this is the famous 17 mind moments. We start with the number one, end of the 17. Five to adverting, you turn towards that, you get the eye. Straight, boring eye consciousness. Alright? Receiving, you receive the visual object. Investigate it. Yeah, you investigate it. Determine it. Okay? So these are just different stages in the perceptual process, and this of course applies for everything, not just eye. So this is the process of actual seeing here. And that's the white ones. And then it has seven impulsions. So in Paul's time, the word is javana, and javana is basically means intention. Okay, so this is basically how you're responding to that visual data. So it's in this javana series that you're making kama. Right? Then you have these two moments at the end of what they call tararamana, registration. That's the kind of just the administrative part of things, just stamping the things and making sure the thing, filing it away, exactly. Yeah, filing it away, and then it lapses back into the life continuum. And notice that the object here of the life continuum is the kama sign or rebirth sign. So this is the kama nimitta or the gati nimitta. It's supposed to be the object of the bhavanga. It means that that's one of the most interesting ideas in this whole thing, actually, of the bhavanga, is that the normal stream of consciousness, which underlies our like conscious awareness. Okay, so what's going on when we're not like a subconscious? Okay, when we're not conscious of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thoughts, that the object of that is the kama, which has created this life. This is what it means when it says the kama nimitta. Yeah, so that those in between bits, in between the active moments of consciousness, the mind actually remembers that act of kama which has brought us into this life. And so that forms, that's why it's called bhavanga, is the factor of existence. It's because that kama has been what's propelled us into this existence. So in a way that, you know, we have a kama today from a past life that propels us into this life and propels us today, our consciousness, to a certain level. Right? And that sort of drifts along at that level. Then we maybe, you know, have a size where we have something, we can go up and down from that level. We can increase our consciousness by doing meditation, go up to a higher level, and practice rupa jhanas or something. We can go down to the hell realms by having unwholesome level. But each time we stop those actions, the mind reverts to this default setting.
Like driving a truck, and you're accelerating, you're doing something, you're accelerating, uh-huh. And then you stop doing it, and then you take your foot off, and it's cruising.
It cruises, yeah.
But can you reprogram
that
default
thing?
What do you
think? Not really, no. According to this theory, no.
Cruise control.
Yeah.
It doesn't really make much sense. What if you don't know? I think it would seem to make sense if you could reprogram it a little bit.
I'm not 100% sure on that, but generally speaking, the idea is that it's that which provides the continuity in life. Mm. So the bhavanga. See, the problem with the Abhidhamma system, or one of the problems, is that it tends towards fragmentation. So it analyzes everything in terms of dispersion and difference, different mind moments and different everything. So the bhavanga is then providing the glue that sticks everything together. So even though, you know, so this, you can see what it's trying to do, even though during a life our mind gets bad and it gets good and it changes all the time, and yet there's something about our life which feels like it's our life and it feels like we're kind of there. And so that bhavanga is a way of sort of theoretically explaining the continuity. Oh, it's something that ties this life together as opposed to the next life.
Now, this impulsion business, why the seven? And what happens?
What happens in each one?
And are they different or are they all the same?
Yeah.
And how can you count them?
I'm not sure. Yeah. You can tell us next week, isn't it?
So you don't know. That's okay. No. That's not.
I can't remember what registration is. It's been so long since I've looked at these things.
It might be a commitment to memory or something.
Something, I think it's saving it to the hard drive.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Oh, what? Impulsion?
The registration.
Oh, registration.
Yeah. My hard drive crashed about halfway through, so.
It had to be very.
Perhaps that's what one
very few life continuum consciousness is.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's kind of interesting, But I think also that the idea of that would be that if you're very highly developed and you've got very strong mindfulness, then you know you're bringing that awareness to everything, and so your bhavanga, you actually have less and less bhavanga. So that your mind is developed in that way. Yeah. So you know, bhavanga is typically, they say, you know, bhavanga is what you experience in deep sleep, for example. Dreamless sleep is mostly bhavanga chitta.
Or wrong samadhi.
Wrong samadhi, you can fall into bhavanga. Yeah.
There's
no bhavanga in jhana. You know, jhana is like an uninterrupted series of mental chitta, of purified mental consciousness.
So what was that again, that if someone is really mindful, that means like there's a consciousness, not they can actually make the bhavanga, that kind of subconscious state lower?
That's right, yeah, they have less frequently. Mm-hmm. It's very quantitative, this whole system. Yeah? And it has a qualitative aspect, but it's very quantitative, is that you have less frequent. You have less bhavanga chittas because you have more moments of mindfulness, more moments of awareness. And you know, just think about it. It's the difference between just walking along the road in a daydream and a daze. You know, your awareness isn't really there, and the difference. So this system, this particular system, sort of tries to quantify that as much as possible. Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah. So it's bhavanga, which is sort of the means. So one of the things that bhavanga does is that it provides an explanation for continuity and causality, like how karma was transmitted and these kinds of things. Yeah, my feeling is that the whole Abhidhamma system, right from the beginning, is essentially a purely theoretical enterprise, and so I don't think that it's actually based on meditative experience very much. Although the, you know, there would no doubt would have been some interaction between the meditators and scholars and things, but I don't think it was. And when you look at the way that it's developed, you know, you can see how. You know, say even in that Dhammasangani, it started out with that list of mental factors, which is taken from the Sutta passage on Nama, and then it's got another list of mental factors taken from the five Jhana factors, and so it's all based on this textual analysis. And so it's I.
The concept of Bhavanga is to give a credit to those other concepts that we're talking about, like different states of mind or consciousness,
mm-hmm.
rather than in itself, it's a meaningful, you know.
That's right, exactly. It's a context. It's providing a context. Yeah. So, yeah.
So the people who are actually using it now, does it mean that they actually put their experience into what they're... into the system?
Well, this is now the great controversy in modern Burmese meditation circles. Now, the orthodoxy in Burma is that this is all absolutely true. Okay, it's true in the ultimate sense. It's the definitive explanation of consciousness, right? But that only Buddhas and I think chief disciples, if I'm not mistaken, can actually see and investigate it directly. That's the orthodoxy as presented in Burmese circles. That's what I've been told. Now, Pao came along and said, no, you can actually see it directly. And so his books were actually banned when they first came out in Burma. Because of that,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he was considered very controversial. Yeah. So these days, I guess he's probably more accepted. But that was one of his innovations.
Each of those moments has got three sub-moments.
Three sub-moments. Yeah. Anukana.
These are.
Yep. Another left diagram. Anukanas. Rising, standing, and passing away.
So it's 51 sub-moments.
Yeah. So if you want to read my critique of this whole system, then this thing I wrote, Mystique of the Abhidhamma, has a as a rather scurrilous and criticism of a lot of these kinds of ideas.
So this, quite this phenomenon, this process, actually it reminds me of systems analysis, and it's supposed to be when I was computing.
Yeah.
No, not systems analysis, putting
processes
and flows and charts and things going here and there. And it's much quicker than a mind map, probably, because ultra high.
Mind moments are really fast.
I know that this is ultra
like
large scale integration. It's
like
extremely fast.
This is faster.
Change is faster than light.
So it's faster than I don't know how many hundred megahertz processor.
Absolutely.
Just a tad.
Yeah.
What is it? Just something 17 million in a light year?
Well, it couldn't be.
Billions.
Mm-hmm. So just
what do you mean it can't be?
Because everything is. Isn't it based on a Rupa? I mean.
Yeah?
That's a lot of these things.
But it's even, but it's even faster than Rupa. It's even faster than Rupa.
Stream of Bhavanga, vibration of Bhavanga.
Okay, anyway, we've got a new Abhidhamma fan here, so let's. We could solve all these problems right now,
no,
or we could go and have a cup of tea. Okay. So. Let's have a. It's baby time.
Bhagavata Dhammo Dhamma Namasam Supatipanno Bhagavata.